accession number 18262, reel 9.
That's a reel 9.
Right, on each lorry that was each allocated to every 30 men, I suppose, was an American, either an international Red Cross nurse or an American Red Cross. I can't remember. They spoke American accent, so I suppose they were American Red Cross on each lorry. And these great big Canadian lorries are opened back once more with seats down either side and a huge exhaust pipe that shot up at the back of the cab. Now, what I remembered the exhaust pipes was, as we were going down the road towards Seoul, the fumes from the exhaust were coming back and nearly choking us from this lorry, really making everyone sick. And we asked if the nurse could do anything about it, and she went up and hammered on the top of the cab and the lorry stopped. And they said the fumes were making us all sick because we hadn't been used to them. And this Canadian's come out and said, yeah, I can do something about that, he said. And he climbed underneath the engine, I'll never forget it, with a hacksaw, and he cut the exhaust pipe off underneath the engine. and I hope we all thanked him for that. And after that, the exhaust fumes was going underneath the lorry all the rest of the way. I'll never forget that. That was a funny thing. Yeah, he sold this thing off. We eventually ended up in the Commonwealth camp, and we stopped there a couple of days. And we were then flown across to Koori, to the Commonwealth Div camp in Koori. Stayed there about a month. They were building us up, more or less, giving us food. There was no control over us. The orders were given that the prisoners were to be given no parades, nothing. Just our wages every Thursday. We could go and we could also take money from the money that we'd saved up the time we'd been in the prisoner of war camp. We could have so much of that if we wanted to spend in Koori for different things. And we stopped there about a month. They built us up with the food and that. And most of the time, well, if you had the money, we used to stop away. We didn't go back to the camp. We'd find a little Japanese guest house and stop the night there, sleep on the floor, you know, because we were so excited to be in Japan. We'd never been into a country like it, where especially a country that was friendly, you know, with everyone, all of us. And the little markets and the little towns. That two or three went to Tokyo, and quite a bunch of them was missing by the time we had to load onto the ship, the Astorias. There was about 90 missing, I think. And they were rounded up in places like Sasebo and Tokyo. They were still spending some of the money they had, and they were flown out to catch us up later on. The Astorias couldn't wait. They left. The ship left, and they couldn't wait for us. And they were flown out and in these planes to catch us up. And they were dropped off at some of the ports that we were stopping on the way, and they flew on ahead of us, and they got into these ports, and by the time we got there, we picked them up when we ended up in places like Colombo and Singapore and places like that, Hong Kong. We stopped in every dock as we came back. And one of the planes was hit by a typhoon, and it was blown off course, and it came down in Indochina on a French airbase. And they said, all the way around the airbase, there was shooting and firing going on. The Vietnamese they'd been caught up in the war in Vietnam, in Indochina at the time. And the Vietnamese were attacking this airfield. And they said they were out of one war into another, and they were frightened they were going to get captured. But lucky enough, they had enough fuel to refill the plane, and it took off again. They eventually caught us up. All the way home, the different places gave us a party. The prisoners gave us a party all the way. And we eventually arrived in Southampton, August 1953. I joined the army in 1949 for an 18-month stretch. After 18 months, it was put up to 2 years, and I had to stop in. And I volunteered for Korea. And it's a thing, I don't know if anyone felt the same as I do, but it's a thing that I think if I had my life over again, I'd do it all over again. And it's a thing that you never forget, and you'd never have any fear of it again. I had no fear of the shooting or nothing. And I would, if I had it all over again, I'd do it all again.
Why?
It was such a looking back on it, it was such a marvellous experience. It was an experience. It was an adventure for us. You must understand, we were young. The majority of our battalion was very young boys. They were only 18 and 19. Hadn't been in the army, some of them, 6 weeks before they were prisoner of war. They'd done their training in England, come out, and they were captured on that day. And it, for me, it was such a marvellous adventure. I don't think I was ever frightened with a shell fire, except the only time when I was on the wrong end of the shell fire, when we crossed the river, that, and where I was being shot at by an aeroplane. That was the only place time I was terrified. But I think the only time that I was terrified, as I was saying, was being shot up by the plane and on the other side of the shelling, that's all. But I would do it all again. I wouldn't have missed it for all the world. It's a marvellous thing that you always remember it. It's in the back of your mind. And sometimes now I often think to myself, and a funny thing comes up in my mind, and I start to laugh. And my wife says, "Well, what are you laughing at?" And I tell her about it. Like a chap, when we were being shot at, he was down behind a little tiny stone just bigger than his head. I'll never forget it. And you couldn't see his head, but you could see his rear end was stuck right up. And funny things like that, you laugh about afterwards. But at the time, it's very, very serious. And you wouldn't dare laugh, but you'd laugh at him afterwards when you told him about it. Lots of things like that.
Did the Korean experience leave you with any long-term after-effects?
Yes, small, not long-term. I don't think it was long-term. I would wake up at night when, at periods of time, when we were in the camp, I don't think I said this in the story, that we would get strafed. The camp would get strafed at night by this American we used to call Bedcheck Charlie. He came over. He used to come over and strafe the camp every so often. He knew it was there. There was huge recognition panels at either end of the camp. He knew there was a prisoner of war camp there, and he used to strafe the road that ran up between the camp. And he used to, lucky enough, he never hit anyone, but he used to put the wind up us. We had to dive into the monsoon ditches because we would lay there awake at night and we could hear this plane droning over, just a single one. A bomber it was. It had drawn over. I think it was one of their old American Marauders or something like that. It was an engine plane. It had drawn over in the darkness. And when you heard the sound of his engine change, you'd lay there listening to it. Directly you heard the sound of his engine changing, you knew he was diving onto the camp. And you dive into the monsoon ditches outside. And we had that several times while we were in the camp. I completely forgot that.
But you were saying about after effects.
Oh, yes. And as for the after effects, for months at night, we live near aircraft, a lot of aircraft up there. I'd lay in bed at night, and I'd be asleep, and I'd wake up in a cold sweat if a plane went over. Used to wake up and listen. I'd be sweating, completely sweating. It used to wake up very tense. And but that was basically all I didn't. I think I'd learned so much. I was a young boy. I was still a young boy when I came out. I had my 21st birthday in the prisoner of war camp. I was still a young lad when I came out. I bear no animosity to no one. I think you learn things by that. It makes you so small. You think how big the world is. I had no animosity towards the North Koreans, the Chinese, or nothing, because I think if the Chinese hadn't came in, a lot more people would have been lost, died of malnutrition, or died in the prisoner of war camps if we'd have been under the North Koreans. And I say, I would do it all over again, because it was such a marvelous experience for me.
Did you make a full recovery from your wound?
At the time when I came home, no. I lost the sight of my left eye, and I'm still blind in the eye now. But when I came home, I went to the hospital, and the eye surgeon looked at it. And he told me exactly what the Chinese doctor told me that visited us in the camp, that the rear of my eye was all burnt where the bullet entered. And the Chinese doctor told me exactly the same, that they couldn't do anything for my eye. It just had to grow back naturally. And it's never grown back, and I've always been blind in my left eye now.
Now, you were telling me something off the record earlier that we haven't recorded about a Korean boy, Kim, before you were captured.
Oh, yes, Korean. I can... Well, it was... Kim was one of our porters, wasn't he? There was no... we never had him in the camp. It was before we were captured, that's right. Yes, Kim was a young lad that Reg Panton took under his wing. A little lad that we picked up on the road. I think all British soldiers do that when they get around to it. They've always got some sort of kid or some sort of dog that's been adopted by the company or a platoon, no matter who it is. They always got a dog or a kid that they adopt. It seems that the British Army is always like that. Well, we picked up this young lad, I'll never forget. We were walking down the road. It was freezing cold. That was our first winter. It was freezing cold and snowing, and this little lad, about 2 foot high, walking down the road, crying his eyes out. We picked him up, and we changed his clothes with us. Although we shouldn't have, really, because he had K-pop clothing on, winter clothing. And we didn't realise that all we had was our army uniforms and that. We changed his clothes, and he took it. And we gave him sort of like a small army suit, a cut down. Reg got someone that was a tailor, and he cut down a small battle dress for him and made it into and gave him a berry, and he was like one of us. Reg had him in the cookhouse. And it was 30 years later, I went back to Korea. And we were in this hotel, it was a Hotel Lottie, I think, in Seoul. And one of the Korean bellboys or someone came up to my room and asked me if I was from B Company. And I said yes. And funny enough, I was the only one in the group that was from B Company. From a whole group that went out, I was the only one from B Company there. I'd been out previously on trips. And funny enough, Reg Panton came on that trip. Our quartermaster, he was on that trip, Reg was. And the boy, he said, there's a Korean downstairs. They wouldn't allow him into their hotel. It was too rich for him. He said, there's a boy downstairs wants to know if there's anyone from B Company. I said, bring him up. And he said, no. I said, bring him up. So he brought him up. And when I opened the door, I knew it was straight away. It was Kim. He'd grown to a man then, but his facial features was exactly the same. I'll never forget his face. And he knew who I was. And I shook hands with him and invited him into my room. He didn't want to come in. And the old, this Korean that was with him sort of didn't like the idea of coming into the room, because hotels out there weren't meant for peasants. They were for people that had money. Anyhow, he came into the room, and I had with me on that trip, he asked if Reg Panton was on the trip with us, and I said no. I said he was in the previous trip. He said because Reg literally saved his life by feeding him, otherwise he would have starved, and he'd never forgotten him. And he was going to go to America. This boy was immigrating to America. He was had a wife, and he said he had two children, and he was immigrating to America. And he wanted to know Reg's address. So, and I didn't know it, and no one in the group knew it, actually. But he gave me an address that he was going to in America. Some of his relations, I think, must have been his relations out there or something. He gave me an address there, the people he was going to in America. And would I get in touch with Reg Panton and get Reg to write him a letter stating that he was an honourable boy, and he'd been an honourable boy, and he'd served with the British Army in Korea, which he had literally. He'd been with us. The only time we dropped him is when we went into the line and then pick him up on our way out. And he was honest and things like that. It was more or less he wanted a letter. It gave him a good, I don't know what the word is. It gave him a good
reference
so that he could go into America. And anyway, when I got home, I phoned up the Gloucester Association office in Gloucester. And who should come on the line was Reg Panton, the chap I was hunting for. And I knew his voice straight away. Directly, he had sort of like a very whine with his voice, Reg did. But he was the nicest chap in the world you could ever wish to meet. And I said, I know who this is speaking. I said, that's Reg Panton, isn't it? He said, Christ, yeah. He said, who are you? I said, Nick Carter. Christ almighty, Nick, he said. Last time I spoke to you was in the prisoner of war camp, wasn't it? I said, yeah. He was, because me and Reg sat out talking one day, I'll never forget it, before they take him away. And I asked him about my wound and that, and he said, oh, I expect you'll get a pension and that when you get out. And I didn't know anything about it at the time. And that was a little talk me and Reg had in the prisoner of war camp. And I knew his voice because, as I say, he wasn't such a nice chap. I said, well, Reg, what do you think? I said, remember Kim? He said, yeah, the little lad we had with us. I said, well, I met him in Seoul. He said, Christ, you didn't, did you? I said, yeah, he came to the room. He said, and he wanted your address. What for? I said, well, he wanted some sort of letter that you could give him because he's immigrating to America. Oh, Christ, he said. Now, I told him what he wanted it for. And I gave him the address over the phone that he had to write to. And Red said, I'll certainly write to him. He said, I'll write him a letter. He said, and I'll give him a letter of introduction, he said. And I've never heard from Red since then, but knowing Red, I expect he did write him a letter.
This propaganda you had, this indoctrination, do you remember anything about it? About what they're trying to do?
Well, they'd have you on lectures on the square, and I don't remember a lot about it. I don't think that we took a lot in. We just, majority of us just used to sit and listen to it and say nothing about it, more or less. You used to get political arguments where you get some chaps that take a little bit in, and they'd argue over it in the huts and camps and things like that. But indoctrination for us wasn't forced into you. You could listen to it or you couldn't listen to it. You had to listen to it, I should say. But it wasn't forced on you. You could sit there and make out you were interested. You could ask questions and make out you were interested. But you no need to took it in. You no need to have taken it in at all. But all the time, every time the interpreter spoke to you, they were indoctrinating you. They were trying to indoctrinate you. Every time you had a meeting, they were indoctrinating you all the way through. But if you wanted to take it in, you could. I mean, some chaps did take it in. Some chap believed in it. In fact, some things, I think, of the communist system were good, but they weren't good for us. They were good for the peasants. Like I remember Chu one day. He came up to us and we were talking. And we were arguing with him over communism, I'll never forget. And he said, when you finish the day in the fields, he said, where do you keep your oxen when you go home? You see, they never had, I don't think they had much idea of what we were living in, the things we were living in, because when we entered Korea, as I was saying, when we entered Korea, we were going to a country 100 years behind the times, comparing to us. And I think China at the time was 100 years, 150 years behind the time. And they were living under Mao Zedong at the time. They were living under Mao Zedong. And the country's economy was by the peasants, not the people that were living in the cities. The peasants were the strong arm of the country. And I think the indoctrination that they had was indoctrinated into their carders and the interpreters that they sent to our camps that could speak English. And all they believed, they was looking at the way we lived, they thought that was the way that they lived, you see. And communism to them was a different word than communism to us. Therefore, we never took it in. So, some funny things, you'd say, give Chu a funny question sometimes. I always remember one day Chu would always run back up to the camp and sell. They had to report to the camp was everything they picked up in the camp. They had to report back to the camp commandant everything they said or heard. And we thought, well, we'll get Chu on this one day. And we knew Chu. He'd stand just outside the hut. And he wasn't he looking up into the sky, looking at the birds or something like that. But he was listening all the time. He was sat on the doorway listening. We knew he was there. And we say, say it out loud, oh, so-and-so in the other hut, he's told me he's going to do a runner tonight, you know, or going to escape tonight. No, not a runner, escape. And he's taken so-and-so with him, let's see. So Chu would hear this, prick up his ears, and off he'd go. We see Chu heading up towards the camp commandant's hut, you know, going to report this, you see. He thought he had something good. And that night, there'd be probably 30 to 40 guards patrolling the camp that night. No one was going to escape. And we used to do that just for devilment. So that Chu would get out there and nothing happened, you see. Nothing had happened. No one had escaped. And next morning they'd go round to this hut and arrest these chaps and throw them in the nick. The names that were mentioned, you see. Of course it would come back to us. Then we'd be laughing about it. And next day they'd be released. And Chu realised that he'd been caught once again because he was so... he'd believe everything that he heard. They were so indoctrinated that way that they had to tell everything to their leader that they heard. And they'd arrest these chaps the following day and talk to them and to ask them why they were trying to escape. And they knew nothing about it. So by getting nothing, knowing nothing about it, they got nothing out of them and they released them back to the camp. And then there, it was their turn to hunt who told the tale on them. And we'd often laugh about it afterwards because the Chinese couldn't prove anything because whenever they arrested them, they'd always go through the chap's belongings looking for food or anything that they saved up, rice or something that they saved up ready to escape with, you see.